يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series taking a close look at the Middle East, North Africa region. Hello and welcome to Middle East Analysis. How delighted I am to say that after a little while, actually, a little hiatus. It's the middle of Advent. We're careering towards Christmas, waiting for the coming of the Word made flesh. I have to say, we have the coming of the international lawyer made flesh opposite. That's Dr. Harry Hagopian. Harry, how are you?
I'm fine, James. It's a pleasure to be here so few days before Christmas.
I hope our listeners forgive the pun there. Good to have you with us. Now, you're travelling in the region. You're in and out of the region, as always. Which leads me to how we're going to tackle this today, Harry. I think what we will do is we will kind of look back, actually, not just over the last year, but over the last 3 years, really. Talk about the uprisings all the way from Tunisia, which I believe is it's been 3 years today, hasn't it?
It has.
So that's a good place
to start. It all started on the 18th of December. And it started with some street vendor in a very rural part of Tunisia that hardly anybody had heard of. He was so fed up with life and the way the state treated him that he burnt himself. He self-immolated. And that was the start of what we have known. Three racy, unpredictable, at times hopeful, at others violent and unhopeful movements across a huge swathe of land that we now call the MENA region, Middle East, North Africa.
Well, we could start with Tunisia, we could start with Egypt. Syria has passed 1,000 days now.
Absolutely. Now, as one of the most credible Syrian thinkers and somebody for whom I have enormous time, Yassin al-Hajj Saleh, said it's 1,000 days. And it looks nice, more than just sounds nice, because you write it with a 1 and 3 zeros next to it. And it amplifies the gravity of what has been happening to that wonderful and historic country, Syria, which is now slowly but surely turning into rubble as a result of human ego.
Now, I know we don't want to go into the full politics of any one of these given
situations. No micro-politics today. It's pre-Christmas. James, don't drag us there. Let's rise above it and let's just look at the region and draw a few conclusions in as much as we can, given how unpredictable and precarious the situation is. And then hopefully, during the course of 2014, our listeners will pick up what we said and show that all we said was wrong.
No doubt. Right. Well, I'm going to start with this then, Harry. Democracy in the MENA region. I'm going to ask you the question, is it a pipe dream or is it possibly an achievable long-term ambition? Should it be the ambition?
It depends. It's a very difficult question, James, that you've asked, and it's almost a loaded question. And when you put it in the cultural setting of the Middle East, North Africa, it becomes even more loaded. Because the first question that I would suggest is, what is democracy? How do we define democracy? Who is allowed or entitled to define democracy? Is democracy what we practice here in this country? Is it what the European Union stands for? Is democracy what the founding fathers of the United States thought of in their constitution? Is democracy what Mandela thought of when he came out of prison and tried to rid South Africa of its apartheid structures and put it on the road to democracy? What is democracy? Is democracy compatible with religion? How do we understand it? Those are all questions that are very difficult to package in sound bites. But what I would say is I am convinced today, in fact, as convinced today as I was 3 years ago when we started accompanying those uprisings with our MENA podcasts, that democracy is a possibility in the Middle East. And that is for a very simple reason. We are now celebrating Christmas. For me, Christmas is only the beginning of a journey. not the end. Because after Christmas comes Easter. And that's where the crescendo lies. And all this shows that we are being freed of the shackles of oppression. We are being reconciled with God in a much minor way, political way. I'm not talking in the same lofty terms now. The uprisings are a way of getting this region rid of decades and decades of oppression, of decades and decades of violence, of subjugation, of discrimination. And there is no way that anybody could argue with me that any one people, be it in the African continent, in the Asian continent, in the Middle East, Europe, wherever you have it, is not entitled to be free. This is an inalienable right of any human being. I believe that as a faith-based person, but also as a lawyer. And I think that what we are seeing at the moment are all the agonies associated with the labor pains that would eventually lead to democracy. You know, my sister-in-law gave birth in 10 minutes. My sister gave birth in 11 hours. Both of them came up with lovely, lovely, beautiful children, a niece from my sister and a nephew to me from my sister-in-law. Why did it take a few minutes for one and if many hours for the other with so much more pain? It's the same birth. It's a human being. But it's different from situation to situation. Now, we both smile because I'm trying to inject a Christmassy note of merriment in our conversation. I don't want this to be too serious. We've done serious. We can do a little less serious today. But what I'm saying is that every human being is entitled to democracy so long as we understand what democracy is. Mm. And for the purposes of the Middle East, North Africa, I would actually encapsulate democracy in two words, statehood and dignity. Those are the two things that have been sorely lacking in the lives of ordinary citizens across the whole swathe of the Middle East, North Africa region. They've had rulers, they've had despots, they've had dictators, they've had totalitarian rulers, they've had anything you want. But there has never been an understanding of statehood which ensures and enshrines those rights of ordinary citizens for their dignity. So what I would say is that all those movements, painful as they are, violent as they are, hopefully successful as they are, because you're absolutely right, we can do Advent 2014 and still be saying the same things. But hopefully, those two twin concepts of statehood and citizenship, which within them enshrine those freedoms and the sense of dignity, the dignity to speak out, the dignity to be, the dignity to be able to eat a slice of bread, this is what it is all about. It is not the indignity of being under inches and inches of thick snow in refugee camps because you cannot go back to your own country because you would be killed or you would be arrested or detained. It is not the indignity of not being able to go out and demonstrate because then the military apparatchik would come and clamp down on you. It is statehood, citizenship. We have to learn that the Middle East men and women and, of course, children are not really citizens because citizenship has rights and responsibilities. They are basically subjects of the big man, the ruler. The minute we start looking at those as citizens, living in a real concept of statehood with the dignity allowed them, then I think we will have started coming out of the throes of those uprisings and convulsions into a formative period where it will be as difficult, if not more than it is now, but hopefully less violent and bloody, where a state has to be built. Structures have to be built so that the Middle East, North Africa jumps from the 19th century straight, hopefully, into the 21st.
Now, I want to look at those that do govern the people, standing at the top of the tree, as it were. Now, you talked about those aspirations of the people and how they should be met. But you look at something, for example, like Egypt, where you have supposedly an elected president, but then after a while, no, let's get rid of him, and then in steps the military and, you know, a new solution. So you go from someone who's ruled for 20, 30, 40 years to the rights of the people to vote someone in. And then, of course, that doesn't work out, so they go. So what is the solution? Isn't Egypt sort of quite worrying when we look at a democratic process, supposedly?
Egypt is worrying. Everything and every country in the MENA region at the moment, what they're going through, at least those countries that are undergoing those violent convulsions, is worrying, James. There are three or four factors that come to my mind. And then I'll come straight to the point about the president and what is it about Egypt and the rest of the region. If we look at what happened 3 years ago, since we started this podcast with the third anniversary of the Tunisian uprising, it initially started with a very hopeful, optimistic outlook on life. We thought, brilliant. The Middle East, North Africa, the Arab population by and large, the masses have woken up. They have risen up, and now we are going to have normal democracies as we understand them, sitting in London, Paris, Geneva, Milano, whatever, Washington, even Moscow. No, what happened initially was that aura of anticipation. Then the second phase that followed it was that reality struck. Reality struck in terms of vested interests. Reality tempered that freshness when tribalism, clericalism, radicalism, vested interests, duplicities, financial needs, proxy wars, everything came and started congregating on this land and pulling the ordinary masses one way or the other. So in a way, the innocence of the initial uprisings was breached, was sullied. And then we are having those continual upheavals with what we see as the weaponization of some of the uprisings, the radicalization, the Islamicization, the violence, which is mind-boggling in some parts of the region, and in some other parts, the remilitarization of the region, whereby the army and the military and the police forces decided, no, they don't like this idea of democracy because it disempowers them. And they want the empowerment that comes from financial as well as physical might. All this is playing into what is happening across the whole region. This whole business of those artificial borders that were drawn up for the region by the colonial powers, where there was no deference or acknowledgement to the tribal lines, who lives where, how do you define the Sunni pockets within a country, the Shi'i pockets within a country, the Christians, the Druze, the Kurds in the north, for instance. All this played into it. And really, the genie came out of the bottle not 3 years ago. Initially, the genie started coming out of the bottle and was straining to come out of the bottle after the invasion of Iraq. Because the second invasion of Iraq, which deinstitutionalized, in other words, it completely canceled all the institutions of the country, created a void. And the worst things, as one of the laws of physics, is that when you have a black hole or a void, it sucks in anything and everything. It started with that. It went into the MENA region, starting with Tunisia. Then immediately after that, we had Egypt, we had Libya, we had Yemen, we had Syria. Some of the other countries are basically sitting on the fence, teetering on either side of that fence. And gradually we started learning that, okay, this is not going to be something that's going to happen in 2 days. That sense of statehood, that sense of citizenship, that sense of the essence of dignity and freedoms is not going to be achieved tomorrow. So gradually people started realizing that this is a long-term issue. And with that, it became an even longer term issue because of all those external powers, from the colonial to the imperial, from the West to Iran to Russia. Everybody started poking in there, messing up the situation, trying to side with their allies against the others. So it became an absolute mess. In this whole mess, the Arab world is trying, the Arab population of the Middle East and North Africa is trying to find its essence, its identity, its statehood, its citizenship, its dignity. So when you talk to me about Egypt, and after this long detour, I come to your question, James. When we talk about Egypt, yes, we had four decades of Mubarak. Before him, we had Anwar Sadat. Before him, we had Gamal Abdel Nasser. All of them come from the military. Suddenly, Mubarak abdicated or was forced to abdicate. You're absolutely right. We had elections. And technically speaking, and I've said this on this podcast and elsewhere, that that was a coup d'etat. Nothing more than that and nothing less than that. Because a legitimately elected president was removed. But why was he removed and how was he removed? He was removed by millions of Egyptians who went out in the streets protesting against him and the way he was running the country. And this is not a question like somebody doesn't like Prime Minister David Cameron's views on abortion, or somebody doesn't like what François Hollande does in France, or people don't trust Barack Obama. They say, okay, we don't like this, we go in a demonstration. The president was completely reorienting the Egypt as we knew it into not being the state of Egypt, but the state of the Muslim Brotherhood. In other words, he who came in on the back of democracy and democratic popular grassroots efforts didn't actually side with the people. He basically sided with his own faction. And he wanted to change Egypt to become basically a haven for the Muslim Brotherhood. This is what the Egyptians rose up against. And this is what they had, what they call their second revolution, and what I call basically a coup d'etat. But what happened is that whilst, and I remember quite distinctly that I said there, it is a coup d'etat by whatever name you want to describe it. However, what happened is I thought, okay, the military facilitated a corrective so that the whole movement of getting Egypt into a new novel phase would not be detracted. What happened is that the military are now gradually reinforcing their position in Egypt, and therefore they're basically cloning themselves on the image of Mubarak and before him Anwar Sadat. In other words, we went forward in order to go backward. Where is my hope in all this? Because if you look at it, you say, blimey, if after 3 years this is what Egypt can produce, and Egypt is the biggest, one of the most important countries in the MENA region, what hope is there, Harry, for all these fancy ideas you bandy around from statehood to citizenship to dignity? Piffle. All you need is somebody to come and hit you on the head and tell you, you go and do what I want you to do. If you don't, I throw you in jail. That is the culture of most, not all, but most of the region. I don't buy that.
But then you've got, let's use the word power hungry then.
Yes.
I think you've got power hungry military in that particular example. Yes. You've got power hungry would-be rulers.
Yes.
That want to seek to mould the country. Yes. And the constitution to whatever they want to do. And the people get forgotten. So it is, you know, we talk hope during Advent, but as you say, I mean, where is that hope?
Yes. Well, there are two things I would say to that. Why I haven't lost my sense of hope and optimism. And it's a hope and optimism, incidentally, which our season is now steeped into. This is Advent. Mm-hmm. What is Advent? It's excitement, it's eagerness, it's anticipation for a miracle that's going to happen. Now, that miracle might take a few weeks, a few months, a few years, a couple of decades. I don't know. But what I would say is that my hope is predicated on the fact that the people who eventually conquered fear, stood up, and got rid of some of their dictators and rulers who wanted to change the way things are, who eventually saw eye to eye with what Arab intellectuals and thinkers have been writing about over and over again. I started my podcast today with you by remembering one of the heroes of the Syrian revolution, Yasin al-Hajj Saleh. I mean, what does the man write? The man wanted an equal society where all walks of society, Christian, Muslim, Sunni, Shi'i, Kurd, Druze, they all live together in a secular country. There are many of those people, but it needs time. And if we go back into our history, because our memories are very, very short, and they're even shorter these days when 24/7 means you see a couple of pictures on the telly, and then you can bet your pound that within 2 hours, that is old story. We've moved on. So 1 minute we're in Central Africa, then we're in Mali, then we're in Syria, then we're in South Africa, then we're somewhere else. There isn't any long-term view. And my thought is that if we look at the history of our own revolutions in the West, if we look at United States of America, the beacon of democracy today as we understand it with its constitution, if we look at France, if we look at the United Kingdom, it didn't happen overnight. So what we need to do is put this in perspective and say, yes, it is painful. Yes, it is violent. Yes, there are going to be reversals. Yes, it's not going to be easy. There are going to be many, many mistakes along the way. But you know what? The day I give up on the hope that things will one day get better is the day when I sell out on my own humanity.
Well, I think as we approach Christmas, we'll leave it on a slight note of hope. I mean, you did, as you always do, gave a little pearl of wisdom there about, you know, there's me being quite negative and, oh, you know, we've come full circle. It started off with a dictator. Then there was a potential coup. You know, it's a pattern we've seen again and again and again. But as you rightly say, the sheer fact that the people are emboldened, if you like, enough to stand up is something we haven't seen before. So that is a positive.
Something that was not seen before. That is something that to me is a sign of hope. And if I look at the history of the world, let alone the history of the region, I can only consider this as another chapter. When the history books are written in 20, 30, 40, 50 years hence, they're not going to say that history started on the 18th of December 2010 in Tunisia and ended when the uprisings ended. This is only one chapter of a long, long history of the region and the world. So yes, do I have hope? I do have hope. Why do I have hope? Because my faith dictates it, but because my beliefs also, culturally and politically, impel me to believe that there is hope and light at the end of the tunnel. Am I right? Am I wrong? I really don't know. But whichever way I look at it, I end up with a Merry Christmas to all our listeners and to you too, James.
Can I get that in Arabic, Harry?
Yes, you can. عيد ميلاد سعيد ولك للعائلة وللجميع لعله سنة خير وتفاؤل. Which means a blessed Christmas to you, your family and everybody. May we hope. لعله. Not it will be. May we hope that it will be a year of optimism.
Excellent. That's Dr. Harry Hagopian, our consultant on the Middle East North Africa region, at Harry Hagopian on Twitter. Must give that a little bit of a plug at the end there. Check out our stuff too, Catholic Bishops Conference of England and Wales, at Catholic EW on Twitter. Harry, thanks ever so much for giving us your time. I know you're not 100%. I know you're flying in and out of the region, so I am most grateful for you being here.
My pleasure, James. And let me leave our listeners with a thought. You said, say something in Arabic. I'm going to say something in Armenian because it goes to the essence of Christmas, of Theophany, of Armenian Christmas. Christos Dznav Yev Haidnetsav. Christ was born and he was revealed. That to me sums it all up. That birth and that revelation is the foundation of what you and I today call our Christian faith heritage.
Excellent, Harry. Thanks ever so much again. And to our listeners, thank you very much. Thanks for passing the year with us. There'll be plenty more in the new year. We will talk Syria. We will talk Geneva too. I think perhaps we should finish just by remembering in our prayers the refugees, those that won't be near their own homes, those that are suffering, those that are dying across the whole region. But let's not forget that element of hope that Harry's talked about. We'll see you in the new year.